This meeting, March 28th, 2023, of the Climate and Energy Committee to order. We have a quorum. The first thing would be the minutes. Representative Hemmingston-Yeager, have you had a chance to look at the minutes? And would you move their approval?
I have.
Thank you. Representative Hemmingston-Yeager moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, with that, the motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Today we have House File 2754, and we'll be doing, we'll be doing a walkthrough and testimony. We're not going to be voting on anything until tomorrow. I will go ahead and, as I'm speaking, just go ahead and move that House File 2754 will be going to Ways and Means. We referred to Ways and Means. And you have an amendment, Madam Chair?
I do, Mr. Chair, the DE1 amendment. If we could move that to put it before us, please.
So the DE1 is moved before us to get it in the, I imagine, in the small package that you would like us to review it. So any discussion on DE1? Do you want to adopt it first and then?
So we're not going to adopt.
Okay, sorry about that.
We're just going to discuss it, and we'll adopt it at another point. So thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks for being here today. We have so much to be proud of already this session in the climate and energy jurisdiction. As we know, earlier this year, the governor signed our 100% clean energy by 2040 bill into law, and just last week, we passed the state competitiveness fund bill off the House floor. That bill will leverage federal funds to help utilities and Minnesotans in many ways to reduce their dependence, our dependency on fossil fuels, to address our changing climate, and to ensure all communities benefit equitably from the transition. But we know the important work of this committee is not yet done, and the bill before you today is that next step. This bill will deepen our commitment to renewable energy and improve our ability to interconnect and distribute clean energy throughout the grid. The bill recognizes the rising cost of energy and works to reduce those costs by improving energy efficiency and weatherization in our homes and buildings. And it also provides opportunities to expand electrification in our transportation sector by providing electric vehicle rebates, funding electric school buses, and expanding our charging infrastructure statewide. We know that disadvantaged communities often bear a disproportionate impact from our changing climate and can often be overlooked in the transition to our clean energy economy. This bill also recognizes how important it is that all Minnesotans share in a clean and carbon-free future. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it back to you and Ms. Ng and Mr. Eloff to walk through the spreadsheet and the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, we're going to walk through the spreadsheet. Ashley Ng, our House Fiscal Analyst, will lead us through that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, Ashley Ng, House Fiscal. I will be reviewing the summary spreadsheet that just includes climate and energy omnibus and not the spreadsheet that has February forecasts and governor's recs included. To begin, we'll start at the top with totals by fund. On line 3, the general fund total spending in fiscal year 24 is $131,632,000. In fiscal year 25 is $43,749,000. 26 is $21,023,000. And fiscal year 27 is $23,919,000. The petroleum release tank cleanup fund, that's total spending, although the bill before us only appropriates $1 million for the compensation board. On line 5, the renewable development account, total spending in fiscal year 24 is $70,394,000, and in fiscal year 25 is $23,121,000. Fiscal year 26 is $592,000, and fiscal year 27 is $192,000. The revenue items on lines 9 through 14, those are spending items that are recoverable through the PUC and the Department of Commerce Energy Resources Division. So that brings the net general fund impact on line 19 to $127,930,000 on fiscal year 24, $39,348,000 in fiscal year 25, $16,622,000 in fiscal year 26, and $19,518,000 in fiscal year 27. Looking at line 36, starting with the Energy Resources Division, total spending, total direct appropriations, line 35 is $116,489,000 in fiscal year 24, $31,693,000 in fiscal year 25, $8,967,000 in fiscal year 26, and $11,763,000 in fiscal year 27. This includes base items listed on lines 36 through 42, and then the governor's recommendations are lines 43 through 49, and then House omnibus additions are lines 52 through 63. So these include the governor's recs are the operating increases, solar on schools, the strengthened Minnesota homes, the weatherization, and the House omnibus items are the electric vehicle rebates, electric vehicle dealer certification, transportation electrification plan proceedings, public building solar grant program, electric panel upgrades, energy storage rebates, clean energy resource teams, building energy benchmarking, Minnesota Climate Finance Authority, electric school bus grant program, air source heat pump rebates, air ventilation program, dispute resolution, and the Anoka Dam study. There was a utility grid reliability assessment sunset repeal, which is line 69 through 74. And then looking down at the Public Utilities Commission, this is the $10,331,000 in fiscal year 24, $10,689,000 in fiscal year 25, $10,689,000 in fiscal year 26 and 27. These include the base funding items as well as the operating increase from the governor's recommendation, and then the four items from the House omnibus, including dispute resolution, participant compensation, transportation electrification proceedings, and the energy storage rebates. These next items go to different agencies. On line 89, there's the Local Climate Action Grant Program, which goes to the Pollution Control Agency for $2 million in fiscal year 24. To the University of Minnesota, there is a U of M Weather Resiliency Program, which is $1 million each year in the current biennium entails. To the Department of Administration, there is the Buy Clean and Buy Fair Act, which is $1,022,000 in fiscal year 24, and then $367,000 in fiscal year 25 and ongoing. And there's the Energy Guidelines for State Buildings, which is $690,000 in fiscal year 24. Looking at the Department of Labor and Industry, there is $100,000 in fiscal year 24 for Energy Code New Commercial Buildings, Energy Code 4. This summarizes the petroleum tank release cleanup fund on line 101 through 117. The item that we track in this committee is the Petroleum Tank Release Compensation Board. So there's the $1,076,000 in fiscal year 24, $1,097,000 in fiscal year 25, and the ongoing, which includes the base funding and operating increase. Looking down at the Renewable Development Fund on line 126 and below, the total spending is $70,394,000 in fiscal year 24, $23,121,000 in fiscal year 25, $592,000 in fiscal year 26, and $192,000 in fiscal year 27, which includes the base funding as well as the additional House omnibus items. For the Department of Commerce, looking at lines 153 through 164, the additional items are the solar contingency fund at the Ford site, electric vehicle rebates, EV dealer certification, public building solar grant program, electric panel upgrades, energy storage rebates, weatherization, EV school bus grant program, distributed energy resource system upgrades, interconnection, and then the small interconnection cost sharing program, the solar on schools, and then there is a solar rewards withholding increase. Looking at the line 177, 178, there's the to the amateur or Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission, there is the $4,200,000 in fiscal year 25 for the National Sports Center solar array. And to the Department of Administration on line 184, there is $690,000 in fiscal year 24 for the weather trend study for state buildings. And finally, on 187, there is $2 million in fiscal year 24 for the local climate action grant program. That concludes the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Eng. So next we're going to have House Research Analyst Bob go through the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be starting with Article 3 in the middle of page 20. Article 3 is entitled Electrification, and the first five sections are from Representative Stevenson's House File 413. Sections 2 and 3 regard preferences regarding electric vehicles and state fleets. Section 4 on page 22 requires dealer training, that's training course offered by the Dealership Association. Section 5 is a new program that requires public utilities and provide a plan to the Public Utilities Commission regarding transportation electrification once every 3 years, and this discusses the content of the plan and the approval process and the cost recovery as well. Section 6, beginning on page 26, is Representative Hansen's House File 2502. It provides grants to accelerate the deployment of electric school buses in Minnesota. At the bottom of page 31 of Section 7, which is also from Representative Stevenson's House File 413, it provides rebates for purchasers of electric vehicles. I'll point out on the near the top of page 33, one thing that has changed since we last saw this bill is that the maximum manufacturer suggested retail price that these cars can have to receive a rebate has been lowered from $60,000 to $55,000, which matches the federal threshold as well. On page 34, this is also from Representative Stevenson's bill, a grant program to certify all auto dealers to sell electric vehicles. And on section 9 is Representative Holland's bill, House File 849, which provide grants to homeowners in single-family homes and also multifamily homes to upgrade their electric panels. At the bottom of page 38, section 10 requires Public Utilities Commission or requires Public Utilities to file at the Commission tariffs related to extending their distribution systems, modifying them to allow for electrification facility upgrades. Article 4 begins on page 39, and section 1 is House File 749 from Representative Ryer. This is all new language that members are seeing here, because what this bill does is respond to the report that was issued in January by the Office of the Legislative Auditor regarding the implementation of the state's sustainable building guidelines. And this language is a response to that report and incorporating several of the recommendations that that report makes to improve the way that the guidelines are implemented by the Center for the Study of Building Research at the University of Minnesota. At the bottom of page 43 is language also from Representative Holland's House File 1386 regarding energy storage. That continues on the next few pages. Section 3 on page 44 requires the commission to initiate a docket to determine compensation for owners of storage with respect to how much they'll be compensated for storage that is sent to the utility during periods of peak demand. Section 4 requires utilities that file integrated resource plans to have targets established for the deployment of energy storage on their systems. The public utilities, the target for the state as a whole is 3,000 megawatts by 2033, and the Public Utilities Commission will allocate those to the various utilities based on their retail sales. Section 5 at the bottom of page 46 is Representative Stevenson's House File 303. That's a change to the definition of low-income household for the eco conservation programs for the state. Section 6 on page 47 is also from Representative Holland's House File 1386. And it requires utilities that have targets established for how much energy storage they must acquire in the coming years to incorporate those targets in their integrated resource plans. At the bottom of page 47 is language from Representative Reams, House File 1983, calling for existing commercial and residential building energy use to be reduced by 50% by 2035. At the top of page 48 is from Representative Bierman's House File 2014. First section is definitions. This is all pertaining to weatherization services. State supplementary weatherization grants account is created on page 48 in section 9. And at the bottom of page 49, a new weatherization training grant program is instituted to make sure there are enough employees to do that kind of work. On page 50 at the bottom is House File 2269 from Representative Kraft for energy benchmarking, requiring buildings to report their energy use annually by means of a computer program from the Federal Department of Energy. And that brings us to page 59 at the top, which is also from Representative Holland's energy storage bill. This language provides grants to homeowners installing energy storage systems that already have solar energy generating systems on their property. And on page 60, section 14 is Representative Akam's residential heat pump rebate program that provides rebates to residential customers who install heat pumps in their homes. Now on page 62, at the top of the page, section 15 is also from Representative Holland's energy storage bill. This is a definition that defines energy storage systems as those with a nameplate capacity of 5 megawatts or more. And it's that threshold that requires a state siting permit for those facilities. The next 7 pages are just technical language incorporating that new definition, which brings us to page 69, House File 772 from Representative Kraft, which requires the Department of Labor and Industry to incorporate the new model commercial energy codes. And beginning in 2036, those codes are required to achieve an 80% reduction in consumption based on a base of 2004. Section 28 calls on the Commission to adopt rules for siting energy storage systems. And that brings us to Article 5 on page 71, which is, Section 1 is Representative Stevenson's House File 393, which sets up a system whereby disputes between customers and utilities can be brought before the full commission for a decision. Page 74 is Representative Holland's 2394, establishing compensation for participants in Public Utilities Commission proceedings. It states the condition under which participants can be compensated and the levels of compensation. That brings us to page 79, Article 6 on climate. Section 1 is the Buy Clean, Buy Fair legislation that requires the setting of standards for various kinds of construction materials used for roads and state buildings. Section 2 on page 85 is Representative Greenman's House File 2336, establishing a Minnesota Climate Innovation Finance Authority, which seeks to accelerate the deployment of clean energy projects by using innovative financing methods and leveraging public and private funds. The next bill is on page 98. It's Representative Akin's House File 1973, which makes some amendments to the state's greenhouse gas emissions reduction targets. At the bottom of that page, Section 4, is Representative Kraft's House File 597, the Local Climate Action Grant Program, which gives grants to local political subdivisions to do climate action projects. And Article 7 begins on page 101. Section 1 there is Representative Hemmingson Yeager's House File 2892, which extends the Xcel Energy's Solar Rewards Program out to 2027 and increases the level of funding for that program. Section 2 on page 102 is Representative Pinto's House File 1021, which provides a contingency fund for a solar array to be built on the old Ford site, which may need some remediation for contamination of that land. On page 104, Section 4 is Representative Akin's House File 2432 on the Community Solar Garden Program, which increases the maximum capacity of gardens from 1 to 5 megawatts and deletes the same county or contiguous county requirement for location, and also establishes a new kind of solar garden called the Community Access Project. On page 109, this is Representative Ryer's House File 2747, which moves the Solar on Schools project that was in Xcel territory from Xcel and sets the project with the Department of Commerce, which has handled the project for the areas outside of Xcel's territory. On page 116 is Representative Breyer's House File 747, which is a program that offers grants for public buildings to install solar panels on those buildings. Section 9 on page 119 is Representative Purcell's House File 2620, which provides grants to Xcel to upgrade their distribution system to enable the interconnection of more distributed energy resources. Page 122 is from Representative Pimenton Yeager's House File 1262, which establishes the conditions under which homeowners association can limit or set conditions on the location of solar energy systems on units within those associations. That goes on until page 128, where section 13 is also from section 13. This is just the transferring any unencumbered funds in Xcel's renewable development account to the Commerce Department, who's taking over the grants for that project. And Article 8 has a number of miscellaneous articles, beginning on the bottom of page 128. The first one is Representative Newton's House File 826, where the language on the bottom of page 132 establishes that construction projects receiving funds from the REA are subject to the prevailing wage rate and some other labor provisions. At the top of page 133, section 2 is Representative Jordan's House File 2100, which provides a grant program to school boards to have ventilation systems in schools assessed and upgraded. And section 4 talks about the grants for that program on page 134. On page 136 is Representative Davis's House File 1650, which changes the dates for some reporting for disconnected customers on the part of utilities. And section 6 at the bottom of that page is from Representative Richardson's House File 49 on utility on diversity reporting. Section 7 at the bottom of page 138 is from Representative Bierman's House File 2035. That's a technical change there. Section 8 on page 139 is also from House File 2035. It just increases from $100,000 to $1 million the value of a plant that, if it's to be sold or consolidated with another public utility, must be approved by the Public Utilities Commission. Section 9 on the bottom of page 139 is new language from House File 2754, and that increases the amount that the Department of Commerce can assess to utilities for work it does assessing energy grid reliability at the state, regional, and national levels. It also, on the top of page 140, strikes the expiration of that assessment authority. Page 140 is also Representative Akam's House File 1656 on State Competitiveness Fund, which we just heard was on the floor the other day. At the top of page 145 is Representative Richardson's House File 49 on Utility Diversity Reporting. At the bottom of page 146, I believe, is Representative Davis's 1650, again, changing the date of a telecommunications report. And in the middle of page 147, section 15 is from Representative Hill's House File 1062, which requires the decommissioning plan for the XL King plant. And at the bottom of that page is Representative Kozlowski's House File 1918, which requires that the Department of Commerce to offer its services for a tribal advocacy council on energy. That concludes my report, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Eliff. So with that, we're going to move to public testimony. First, we have Michelle Grancy, Deputy Commissioner. Welcome back to the committee. Please state your name and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, representatives. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Michelle Grancy. I serve as the Deputy Commissioner of Energy at the Minnesota Department of Commerce. I'm standing in for Commissioner Arnold and testifying to express the department's strong support of House File 2754, Climate and Energy Omnibus Bill. HF 2754 includes important policy and budget items poised to benefit every Minnesotan and help the department to continue with its goal to promote clean, reliable, and affordable energy for Minnesota homes and businesses. As you may know, the Division of Energy Resources at the Department of Commerce serves in regulatory, policy, and programmatic roles. We serve as the Minnesota State Energy Office. We administer both the low-income energy assistance and weatherization assistance programs. We provide environmental review for large-scale energy projects and host the Energy Information Center. We provide energy-related granting and contracting activities, financing and funding programs, and multiple areas of technical assistance. And we lead out on energy-related IIJA and IRA informational outreach. We oversee Minnesota's Utilities Conservation Improvement Program and advocate on behalf of the public interest in proceedings involving regulated utilities on energy and telecommunications. And finally, we maintain cross-unit functions related to energy reliability, transmission planning, energy resiliency, and state energy security planning. I mention all this because while recognizing that not all of the funding levels line up exactly, I am deeply grateful to see the governor's budget for commerce has been included in House File 2754. Namely pre-weatherization and workforce training program to provide more services to additional income-eligible households throughout Minnesota. That it includes the Strengthen Minnesota Homes program to make homes more resilient to Minnesota's ever-changing climate. that includes solar for schools to expand this highly popular program to reduce energy costs in schools and serve as a teaching tool for students. That includes ongoing grid reliability assessment authority to ensure effective state, regional, and national reliability planning efforts are coordinated with Minnesota's interests. That includes energy resources and planning funding to be responsive to an increase in the number and complexity of regulatory proceedings. And finally, that includes continuing agency operations so that commerce may maintain continued capacity to be effective stewards of resources. I also express my gratitude and support for including Commerce Department policy proposals in this omnibus, namely the Tribal Advisory Council on Energy and the Commerce Department Technical and Housekeeping Bill. These policy proposals will provide the Commerce Department the necessary tools to continue protecting the public interest, lower inequities, and support commerce in a continued role as a trusted public resource for consumers and businesses alike. For these reasons, I urge your support of House File 2754, the Climate and Energy Omnibus Bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Joe Sullivan. Following Joe, we have Will Seifert. Mr. Sullivan, welcome back. Please reintroduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
I don't want to blow up your spot there.
Thanks. Thank you, Chair Acom, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joe Sullivan. I'm a commissioner on the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, and thank you for the opportunity today to comment on House File 2754. The Minnesota Public Utilities Commission appreciates the hard work of the committee this session, and as you know, the commission regulates three cornerstone service industries in Minnesota's economy, electricity, natural gas, and telephone service. We do that to ensure that the public receives utility service that is safe, reliable, and affordable. Passage of this bill will allow the commission to efficiently implement regulatory proceedings with robust public engagement. Over the past decade, the Commission's regulatory oversight, especially in electric and gas utilities, has increased in response to market dynamics, evolving utility business models and energy technologies, and state policies. Furthermore, the Commission has welcomed an increasing volume of our public comments and widespread interest in the energy issues before the Commission and the state. And at the same time, the work required to fulfill the Commission's traditional regulatory responsibilities has become increasingly challenging as utilities implement new programs and the energy industry transitions towards a cleaner, more connected, and more complex grid. Recent major federal and regional actions will significantly impact PUC activities. These include the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, and the Mid-Continent Independent System Operators Long Range Transmission Project. Tranche one of that four-part project has been approved. These historic initiatives include significant investments in the energy system and have the potential for widespread ratepayer benefits and carbon reduction. And this budget will allow the agency to manage the various proceedings required to implement these acts. Oversight of the utilities is vital in ensuring that service is safe, reliable, and affordable. And maximizing the benefit realized to Minnesota ratepayers.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Will Seifert, Executive Secretary, Public Utilities Commission. Just a couple comments on the policy article. While the Commission doesn't traditionally take positions on policy matters before the legislature, there are some considerations that we would like to flag for members of the committee pertaining to the policy articles of the bill as this bill advances through the process. First, the Commission has some general concerns about the bill's inclusion of automatic recovery mechanisms, also known as riders, for utility cost recovery. The traditional rate case process involves extensive review of the full picture of a utility's finances. The increasing number of riders makes it more challenging to balance rate impacts and ensure the utility's interests are aligned with the public interest. We would urge caution in approving new riders. In its current form, the bill authorizes automatic recovery for expenses related to electric vehicles and EV school bus infrastructure. commission has done extensive work on EV dockets in recent years. It has given us important perspective on both policy and technical matters. Establishing a requirement for utilities to file transportation electrification plans is a good decision that will help utilities ensure the grid is ready as the use of electric vehicles increases. These plans will also provide a good forum to discuss important questions that have been raised by stakeholders about equity, competition, cost recovery, and other issues. The Commission appreciates the work that members and stakeholders have done on the EV-related sections in this bill and looks forward to participating in future discussions on this initiative. In addition, we want to make sure the committee is aware of a significant docket pending at the Commission relating to electric vehicles. In docket 22-432, Xcel has requested approval of a package of electric vehicle programs it refers to as its clean transportation portfolio. The electric vehicle legislation you are considering would likely have some influence on the outcome of this docket and how the costs of the program affect ratepayers. The Commission recognizes the importance of energy storage in meeting the carbon-free requirements recently enacted, which is why storage is currently included in our integrated resource planning process. We believe that much of the language in this bill can complement our resource planning process, but we would caution the committee against being overly prescriptive in mandating targets that may duplicate work ongoing in other dockets. Finally, there are significant changes proposed to the Community Solar Garden Program in both bodies that we hope are further evaluated. The program has the potential to provide widespread benefits to ratepayers, but as you're aware, there have been concerns raised about equity, cost, and interconnection. The Commission looks forward to serving as a resource as the committees work to produce final language. In closing, we want to thank the members of the committee for their hard work this session and urge passage of House File 2747. Thank you for considering our feedback, and please continue to use us as a resource as you continue your work on this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Seifert. I believe you meant 2754.
That's precisely what I meant. Thank you.
All right. Next, we have Colin Beery. Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Beery. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Up next is John Thorson.
Chair, members in the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Colin Beery. I handle government affairs for the Sheet Metal Workers Local 10. I'm here to speak on speak in support of the air ventilation pilot program provision. Acknowledging that this program will be run by the Department of Commerce, it was heard in the Commerce Committee this year. The air ventilation pilot program outlines grants awarded for reimbursement of physical ventilation assessments in school facilities. When an assessment is performed on the mechanical system, it will identify the energy deficiencies from the equipment to the vast distribution runs that allow heating and cooling to flow throughout a facility and all the dynamic components that function to provide energy efficiency inside school facilities. While the assessment will primarily address energy deficiencies, in the same process, indoor air quality solutions will be identified. When understanding the mechanical system's full potential for energy efficiency and air quality, we see them as intertwined. Not one or the other, they work in harmony. Our members work in vertical construction, fabricating, installing, upgrading, and maintaining HVAC systems. We see the creation of the air ventilation pilot program as a step towards addressing energy efficiency, human health, life safety, and cost savings, in so improving the full indoor environment in our school facilities. We ask for the committee's support of this provision in House File 2754 as amended, and thank Chair Aikum and the committee members for their consideration.
Thank you. Okay, next we have John Thorson. Welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Thorson. I'm Legislative Director of Liuna, Minnesota, North Dakota. We're Minnesota's infrastructure union, representing more than 13,000 skilled construction laborers who proudly build and maintain our state's transportation, water, energy, and building infrastructure. Liuna is committed to a clean energy transition that makes our state industries and workforce stronger, more prosperous, and more competitive. We've put forward a simple principle. Clean energy jobs should be just as good and just as available to local workers as the conventional energy jobs that have provided family-supporting employment to generations of Minnesotans. Madam Chair, in many ways, House File 2754 advances this goal. We want to begin by expressing appreciation for the committee's efforts to strengthen labor standards across a number of program areas, including the addition of prevailing wage requirements for the Climate Innovation Finance Authority, electric school bus deployment, electric panel upgrade, solar on public buildings, and projects funded by the renewable development account. We would note there are a couple provisions where prevailing wage standards are not yet in the bill, specifically the community solar garden program and for storage systems subject to permitting through the Public Utilities Commission. We'd also like to thank the chair for including buy clean provisions and Mr. Chair, for working with stakeholders on the commercial building efficiency provisions, which we support. As committee members know, Lena strongly advocated for the 100% clean energy bill. We believe that ambitious, renewable, and carbon-free goals can be met, but only if we give utilities the flexibility and tools needed to meet the goals reliably and affordably. We do have some concerns with how provisions in the DE amendment could impact efforts to reach the 100% goal. First, we support deployment of community-scale solar generation, but harbor reservations that the current drafts could increase the costs to ratepayers and also lacks the labor standards, prevailing wage and local hire, and transparency that House File 7 provided for utility scale resources. We look forward to participating in future stakeholder discussions as the bill moves forward. Second, we also support the deployment of battery storage, and we appreciate the inclusion of language proposed by Representative Hollins to clarify and simplify permitting rules for such. But as we indicated in previous testimony, we worry that the storage mandate may result in new costs to ratepayers and direct benefits toward corporate and wealthier customers at the expense of lower income ratepayers. And third, we've worked diligently with the Citizens Utility Board to arrive at a version of expanded intervener compensation that maximizes benefits and minimizes impediments to expansion of clean energy infrastructure. The language in the DE does not include progress we made negotiating with CUB, and again could end up forcing ratepayers to foot the bill for organizations and individuals whose aim is to prevent needed utility investments. We would ask the committee to consider making changes to address concerns raised not only by us and organized labor, but also by leading clean energy developers represented by the Clean Grid Alliance. Chair Akam, I'd like to thank you for bringing forward this bill and commit to working with you to create and maintain thousands of good-paying union jobs and drive economic growth in every corner of the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have J. Drake Hamilton. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Akam, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is J. Drake Hamilton. I represent Fresh Energy, where I'm the Senior Director of Science Policy. Fresh Energy is a 30-year-old Minnesota-based nonpartisan nonprofit organization that works to achieve equitable carbon neutral economies. This is my first time testifying in this committee. Fresh Energy strongly supports the Climate and Energy Omnibus Bill. I will be brief and call out a few of the sections of House File 2754. High in Fresh Energy's work was the Electric Panel Update Grant Program for a total of $55 million between the General Fund and RDA, and the Distributed Energy Resource System Updates, $10 million, also from the RDA. Thank you, Chair Akam, for including these two programs in the omnibus bill. Fresh Energy is especially enthusiastic for one more of the bill's programs. That is the $20 million for the Minnesota Climate Finance Authority. We do have concerns about one provision, GUIC's five-year extension. Fresh Energy expressed our concerns in detail in a letter submitted to this committee on March 14th. However, we look forward to working more with Chair Akam. Thank you, Chair Akam, and to all members of the committee and your fine staff. We are served well by everyone's busy days and even busier evenings. Thank you for providing this valuable testimony time. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Brian Cook. And following Brian is going to be Johnny Johnson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Great. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Chair Akam, members of the Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee. My name is Brian Cook. I'm the Director of Energy Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber, which represents over 6,300 businesses of all sizes with more than 500,000 employees, believes in a triple goal of affordable, reliable, and cleaner energy. I appreciate the opportunity to express some of our concerns with the Delete Everything Amendment to House File 2754. Electricity prices for Minnesota businesses and families are increasing rapidly, and they're increasing faster than the national average. Since 2002, the average cost for large electric users nationwide has grown by 42%. In that same time frame, the cost in Minnesota has grown by 91%. What used to be a competitive advantage for Minnesota companies has disappeared. We are failing to meet our state's electricity cost goals. Now, my testimony is not focused on whether some of the spending programs in the bill are a good idea or a bad idea. Instead, the focus is on the funding mechanism, customers' electric bills. The bill would spend around $90 million out of the renewable development account. The RDA is funded by a specific tax that only Xcel Energy customers pay, established as part of a negotiated agreement to license nuclear facilities in Minnesota. Spending out of the RDA is spending utility customer money. The bill also contains several provisions, such as the ones relating to electric vehicle infrastructure and energy storage mandates that are funded through cost recovery that comes directly out of customer electric bills. This budget bill utilizes these mechanisms in ways that cumulatively cost hundreds of millions of dollars for utility customers and will cause additional upward pressure on the prices they pay every single month. While these proposals may not show up on a budget spreadsheet, someone is paying for them. That someone is Minnesota utility customers. Briefly, I would also like to voice again our concerns with the energy benchmarking mandate and the provision relating to the state's energy code. Specifically to the energy code provision, we request that the House adopt the Senate's version of the language contained in their labor finance bill, which fully addresses the concerns of the business community. The cost trends for electricity in the state are concerning, and we hope as this bill makes its way to the governor's desk, a little bit more can be done to ensure Minnesotans are not stuck paying more than they can afford for electricity. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next, we have Johnny Johnson. Welcome to the committee. Please do state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, committee, how midakiapi, mitawa kodapi, chante washte na pechi yuzapi, wiohanta sampa washte. I said in my language, good afternoon. I come here with a good heart and a warm handshake. My name is Johnny Johnson. I'm the president of the Prairie Island Bitawakatuan, those born of the water, Dakota community. My testimony today is about a topic that has recently developed into the public policy issues that we are asking your help with, and the matter of great importance to my tribe. As you may know, the Prairie Island nuclear plant went into operation in 1973, adjacent to our reservation. At that time, we were all made aware that there was not any due diligence done on the impact that the plant would have on our small community, struggling community, I'm sorry, which is located on the same little island. The tribe did not have the resources to ask questions of the company or engage in the regulatory process or the legislature. The Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs, who has legal responsibility to protect the tribe also failed to do anything. We were forgotten. In fact, because our relatives, including my father, were in poverty, a number of tribal members worked on the construction of the plant given the lack of economic opportunities at the time. They did not know what they were helping build was a nuclear plant that we would be dealing with for decades. The plant was put into operation with the idea that the federal government would construct a national repository for the nuclear waste. As we all know, there was a site in Nevada, Yucca Mountain, that was designed by the federal government for the nuclear waste. Yucca Mountain never became viable despite tens of billions of dollars spent. So in 1994, the Minnesota legislatures authorized dry cast to be stored at Tintawinta, which means Prairie Island. This time the tribe adamantly opposed, but it was passed despite our concerns. As part of that legislation, the tribe was named a third-party beneficiary of the agreement between the state and Xcel Energy. The agreement was renegotiated in 2003 when it became clear that even more cast would be needed on site at the Prairie Island nuclear plant. As part of the renegotiations, Xcel agreed to pay Prairie Island, my community, $2.5 million annually. To this day, we are the closest, and I repeat, the closest community to a nuclear power plant and spent nuclear waste in the country. But we do not receive the typical financial support of a host community and have no choice but to bear the responsibility for our community members' health and safety. The surrounding communities have received hundreds of millions of dollars from the placement of the nuclear plant on Tintawinta. For example, the city of Red Wing received over $232 million in tax revenue through the year 2021. Going forward, they will receive hundreds of millions of dollars more. Because of this shift in state policy to move to 100% carbon-free energy, the life of the Prairie Island nuclear plant will likely be extended. Due to this anticipated relicensure, an updated arrangement that Xcel and the tribe that we would like the legislator to authorize would recognize the burden we bear and the needs for resources to provide safety to our community. Xcel and the tribe are seeking to increase the payments to the tribe generally track with the surrounding community tax revenues such as Red Wing. To be clear, relicensing is a major issue for our community and one that causes us fear. The state has enjoyed baseload carbon-reduced energy since the early 1970s. All the while, the plant and waste sits on our sacred lands, less than 700 yards from our people, the livelihood, and over all objections. We are now facing at least additional 20 years of operation beyond what the plan was intended for, until 2053 and 2054. Our burden and risk grows for all next generations. Therefore, we believe that it is only right that the current agreement should be updated to reflect the burden that the tribe carries. We look forward to continuing our discussion on this issue with the chair and committee members. Wopi Latanka, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Beshe. I'm here on behalf of Associated Builders and Contractors of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to provide some comments on the Delete Everything Amendment to House File 2754. ABC represents 330 commercial and industrial contractor members, as well as 20,000 men and women they employ, who are part of the 76% of the construction industry in Minnesota that choose to be merit shop craft professionals rather than join a union. There are three particular issues that I would like to speak to today. The first one is that ABC is opposed to the prevailing wage mandates that are in this bill. This includes the mandate that prevailing wage be paid on RDA projects. Prevailing wage mandates increase the cost of labor and result in higher overall construction projects costs. In addition, there is absolutely nothing in prevailing wage law that requires local workers to be employed on these projects. Second, while we support the underlying purpose of the air ventilation program pilot grants, our members are opposed to the requirement that the work be performed by workers who have either graduated from or are currently participating in a registered apprenticeship program. Registered apprenticeship is one way of learning a trade, but it is not the only one. There seems to be a misconception that a contractor can only perform work safely if they've participated in a registered apprenticeship program. However, we've seen real-life examples of how this isn't the case. For instance, the tragic explosion at Minnehaha Academy in 2017 involved a worker who had completed a union-registered apprenticeship program. Despite completing that program, the National Transportation and Safety Board report found that the worker was not qualified to work on that section of piping at issue. The bottom line is that a registered apprenticeship program is not the sole indicator of safety. ABC members have their own in-house training and take a lot of pride in the safety of their workers. We're also concerned that this requirement will have an impact on minority-owned companies who largely don't participate in those registered apprenticeship programs. There are concerns that this requirement will make it more difficult for companies to compete for the work due to the poor track record of registered apprenticeship programs admitting people of color. This requirement will act as a deterrent to contractors from bidding and competing for these school construction projects, resulting in fewer bids and higher costs. This is not something that school districts and taxpayers deserve. Finally, we are the language that would allow Minnesota Climate Innovation Finance Authority to discriminate against merit shop contractors by requiring projects to implement a project labor agreement as a condition of receiving financing. Government-mandated PLAs are the exception, not the norm in construction. They require a contractor to become signatory for the life of a project, require merit shop contractors to hire union employees at the expense of their own employees, and require merit shop contractors to pay into union benefit funds that their own employees won't ever benefit from. The lack of a PLA does not mean that union workers can't work. They've successfully been able to work on countless projects across the state without PLA mandates. In contrast, the only work that will get taken away is from the 76% of Minnesota's construction workers who aren't in a union and won't be allowed to work on these energy projects. These projects are also already subject to prevailing wage law, so if you believe that prevailing wage mandates ensure that only local contractors bid on projects in Minnesota, there shouldn't be any concern about supposed low-wage, out-of-state contractors taking work away from Minnesota workers and companies. In closing, as it's currently written, we encourage the committee to vote no on this bill, and we respectfully request that the bill be amended to address these concerns. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Akam, for having me today. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Chris Clark on behalf of Xcel Energy, and with me is Bria Shea, who's our Vice President of Regulatory Policy. We weren't sure which of us was going to be able to make today's hearing, so we both signed up, so thank you for accommodating us. Over the last several years, As I've been president of Xcel Energy's Minnesota company, along with North Dakota and South Dakota, I've had the honor of working with President Johnny Johnson and his predecessor. And as you can tell, it's a tremendous honor to be able to work with Johnny and the tribal council. They have treated us with respect. They have honored us as we have come and met with them. We have had open and honest dialogue. We have covered subjects that are tough in our history, and we have made progress. We have much more to go, but we have made sincere progress. Johnny and his tribal council have been meeting with their membership and sharing the work that we have done to reach a new agreement, as he talked about. I'm proud of the work that we have done together. We wanted to respect their opportunity to meet with their tribal members and to share what we were working on and ensure that they had the consensus of their community. So I apologize for us not bringing this here at the beginning of the session, but it was important that we did that work, and we did it together, and we did it with the mutual respect that we have come to share with each other. I am hopeful that this committee and the Senate will see the way to include the updated language to allow us to amend the current payments to the tribal community. Let us recognize that they are a good neighbor to us. They are the closest living community to stored spent nuclear fuel. We work hard to run a safe plant. We work hard to be a good neighbor. But we think it is important that they are treated equally as a neighboring host community, and that they have the opportunity to make the investments that I know and that we have spent much time talking about they want to do for their community, in their housing, in their workforce, in their opportunities, in their lands, and in their pursuit of bringing other lands that they have acquired into their sovereign nation. I think it is a great path for us here in Minnesota to make this move as we chase the 100% by 2040 goal. And as Johnny said, relicensing the nuclear plant is a key part of that. We're excited to help achieve a 100% by 2040 goal. We're up for that challenge, but it does come with the need to extend the license of our Prairie Island Units 1 and 2. We're committed to continuing to make the investments to be a safe nuclear operator, to run one of the best fleets in the nation. But I also want to be a good neighbor. I want to honor the commitments that we feel are appropriate, and I think reflect positively on the state of Minnesota about how, as we make this transition to 100% clean energy, we're here to include all of us. So, Chair Akam, thank you for your work. Thank you all for your work, Mr. Chair and committee members. We look forward to working with you and appreciate your consideration of our request at this point. Thank you again.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else in the public that wishes to testify? That's all we have on our list. So at this point, we've got 25 minutes left for questions. We're not taking any votes on the bill today, but I'll open it up for member questions and discussion. Representative?
Thank you, Madam Mr. Chair. just a general question. We've got a few. I thought we were going to have a few more folks come before us to talk about this, but you know, we heard some concerns from the commission. The cells very particularly. On the prescriptive language on the battery storage, and we've spoken about this in the past. So from a battery storage standpoint, from industrial installations of solar, and the heavy weighting of the way that's prescriptive for community solar and the expansion of the program, is there anyone in the room that could explain to me? So right now, it appears that the current community solar program displaces about 50% of solar installations that would be done by Xcel. With the weighting to make it more expensive and less economical to do industrial with the battery storage, the three megawatt or 3,000 megawatt mandate on that, and then plus with the expansion of the community solar program, is there any idea how much would actually get built in each of those programs? If already half is being displaced, what's the estimate by the industry folks or Excel? If this bill were to happen, how much new production would be built using those particular programs? Madam Chair, do you know?
I don't know. I don't have answers to those questions.
Do you have a guess?
So I don't know that I fully understand what you're trying to get at, Representative. Maybe you could try and restate it again, please.
So under current law, between the community solar program, about half of, so if Xcel Energy goes before the rate, before the commission, the PUC, to say we have plans to build, let's just say, 1,000 acres of solar. Currently, it's believed that they are lessening the amount of allotment for them to go out and produce it because of the unknown of what will come on board through the community solar program, to the tune of almost half. If you expand the program the way you're prescribing, mm-hmm. by creating a new program and then double down on the old and allowing it to go statewide, so it's not really a community program anymore, what is the estimate of how much more, let's just say, cheap solar will be displaced by the community solar type program? Do we know? I mean, this is a huge change in policy. Mm-hmm. And if no one can answer the question, we have no idea, then you shouldn't probably have this in the bill.
Terry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. I would say, first of all, your comment about if it's statewide, it's no longer community, I think that's not necessarily true. I mean, I think we're building community near the communities that are being, where it's being used. So I think that's the community term within the title. And as far as how much displacement, I think that, as I said in our hearing on community solar, I think that there is a place and a need for rooftop, for community solar, and for utility scale. And I think they all play a different role, and there are pros and cons to all of them. And when we look at utility scale solar and the needs for investments and improvements in transmission to accommodate, that can raise that cost considerably. And so one of the benefits of community solar is that these smaller arrays can be much more flexible and fit in areas where there may be space within the grid. And so I don't take your premise that there is a displacement of costs and that it's displacing larger utility. I don't agree with that premise, and I think that there is a need, and in conversations that I've had with Xcel, they have shared the recognition and need of both utility scale and community solar.
Mr. Chair, Representative Akam, you know, I get that it's maybe an uncomfortable conversation to have, but it is. I mean, we went over it in committee that the current fuel cost is, community solar is estimated that it produces, what, 3% of the energy output, but is 17% of the fuel cost that's passed on to ratepayers. And so that's all cost shifting. So if you're Warren Buffett, or if you're Target, or you're Walmart, or you're Best Buy, and you buy into community solar and are developing it across the state, that's all shifting. All those costs get shifted onto other ratepayers. And if under current law up to this point, 17% of the fuel cost goes to that particular program, and we're going to vastly expand it, and then also raise the cost through the battery storage program of 3,000 megawatts of mandated battery storage on any new industrial solar, which is the affordable one of the two, that the weight is going to get pressed harder into the camp of community solar programs because of the way the cost structure is, maybe a less appetite by the industry to actually build industrial rate solar, and the competition that we're going to have with all the money flowing in towards those programs. is there an estimate on how much, if this bill is to go forward, if already 17% of the fuel cost across the board is community solar, is it going to be 50? Is it going to be 60? Is it going to be 70% of the fuel cost on ratepayers for maybe 10% of production? I mean, that's literally what we're looking at with that small part of the bill. And what is it? I mean, that's why I think it's so important, Madam Chair, that if you're going to be opening up this program particularly for development, that you'd at least put a cap on it so you could understand, like, no more than 5% of the grid should be powered by this, or whatever you might do, so you could at least have a potential cap on it. You know, the only real restriction in this whole program is the contiguous counties, and you're getting rid of it. That was the only thing even slightly holding this that particular program back, which is the most expensive in the country. On ratepayers. This isn't just, you know, this isn't getting Big Bad Wolf and knocking his house down. This is knocking down every single person's across the state who doesn't happen to be well connected and, you know, have either their own solar program on their house or participating in a community solar program. And I would just urge you that if you're going to move this bill forward, that you would consider it. I know you've talked, I know Representative Hollins has talked about the realities of the situation moving forward. And I understand it's nice to get these bills in, but what we don't really even understand what the ramifications are to the ratepayers.
Before I pass on, I just want to, you made a statement about 3% and 17%. I thought that was it was disputed by some of the community solar experts in the hearing at that time, but I'll pass it over to you, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. I do think when we talk about the community solar program, there are concerns about cost, and there are concerns about how much is enough, and what are resources that the utility would like to be able to count on. And so I think there are a whole lot of criteria that are being taken into account as we look forward from the bill hearing, and there are conversations being had about how we can address those costs, how we can ensure that this can be a program that is reliable and have expectations not only for the development community but for the utilities. I think that those are really important considerations that need to be taken into account and need to be included in any final decision. And so in that, absolutely, caps are being talked about, and ways we can contain cost and make it more affordable, and frankly, in that also to make it more equitable. To date, there has not been a huge participation by those in low and middle income residential situations to participate in community solar. So absolutely, you bring up really good points, and they are absolutely the issues that are being talked about as we move the bill forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, and that's what this committee hearing is about, is so that we can flesh those ideas out. Mm-hmm. So we don't have conversations in back rooms. I'm not invited into that room as a representative of 40,000 people in my district, and I do have XL territory as a portion of my district. And so, you know, I would ask you, Madam Chair, that if those conversations are going, if there are, you know, this is your amendment. This is your bill, which is mm-hmm. now, it's still in the form of an amendment. We haven't mm-hmm. taken any action on it.
Mm-hmm.
So let's have that. Let's, you know, if there are portions on it where we could have a cap, you know, what is it? You know, let's amend this amendment, and let's talk about it between now and next week or tomorrow so that we can have an amendment that will do that, or at least have that conversation, because I think that's what concerns us, is that, you know, we did have this conversation weeks ago, concerns about community solar in particular, among other issues, and, you know, we heard, you know, folks from the ABC and with there's no guarantee that a local person, so like it down in Southwest Minnesota, if we're utilizing one of these programs, and, you know, you're going to call local labor, someone from Minneapolis coming out because they happen to belong to a union, and excluding the folks that have been doing the work for the last 10 years in that local community, I don't think that's very fair. I don't think that's right. And, you know, I think we have a lot of different things in here that we should be able to take a look at. And I don't know what Mr. Chair, what is the timeline? Are we going to stay here later tonight, or are we done in 15 minutes?
We're done at 4:30.
4:30, okay. I'll open it up for other members, but I do have more questions, if there's other people on the list.
Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I just wanted to speak a little bit to our two testifiers that came. First, I just want to thank President Johnny Johnson for your very eloquent testimony, and I do appreciate you coming here. Also to Excel. And, you know, in all of us for our quest to have clean energy and the 2040 bill, you know, these two testimonies to me were two testimonies that just made a lot of sense. Nuclear is reliable, clean, and affordable energy. And unfortunately, that power plant has been right next to Prairie Island. And this is an example of two entities literally coming together, working out a big problem, coming to the table, having discussions together. And they have just come to our committee with a recommendation that they both agree on. And I think there's a lot of people in this committee on the Republican-Democrat side that could use these two as a prime example of how we could work together for energy policy. I have seen in this committee millions and millions of dollars coming across. And to me, this makes a lot of sense. And I would just recommend to this committee that this is amended into our bill.
Question in there. I don't have anyone else on the list for questions at this point, unless Representative Swiedzinski, you wanted to. We've got 13 minutes.
So. Sounds good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to steal anyone else's questions. If they don't be afraid. I'll take the time up. If someone does, just let me know. If someone else raises their hand, I'm gladly to give up the microphone. Mr. Chair, Representative Acom, looking at the bill, what is the estimated costs to rates? So, you know, everything's done for a reason. You know, whether you're in tax committee, you know, we have a good estimate. When we pass a tax policy, there's kind of a give and take, we understand. What are kind of the unfunded? I know you had a target about $255 million. Plus the spending of the RDA funds, and I would agree with Representative Altendorf. You know, that's probably a great place. That if there is an agreement between Excel and Prairie Island, you know, I think that could be very respected, and I think it does it in a way that doesn't raise rates. Even though we disagree that the RDA should exist at all, because that is a tax on ratepayers that they could actually use the relief right now. You look at the cost of energy, I think, you know, if we were to if I had a magic wand, I've asked you that in the past, if I had that magic wand, I would return all the money that's in the RDA to ratepayers at the rate that they paid it to drive the cost of the cost of doing business here in Minnesota down. And I understand those funds, and we might have an opportunity on the floor or in committee to have an amendment like that to have that choice we can really show to Minnesotans what we're focused on. Are we focused on special projects, or are we focused on really delivering? One of the main caveats of state policy is 5%. Are we 95% of the national average when it comes to the cost of electricity? And those are important things. And so my question: what other costs? So you have a target of $255 million. Of general fund and other spending, what is going to be the cost through the mandate and the policy push to local units of government, to XL ratepayers, and to cooperatives and municipalities because of any mandates of and requirements in this bill?
Chair Acom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to back up on that and first talk about the nuclear plants and the development of the RDA. And so while nuclear is carbon free, it also comes with nuclear waste. And so the risks to communities really center around that waste, and it was with that in mind that we developed the RDA to ensure that we could develop other forms of energy generation that would not put communities at risk. And so just want to kind of set that as an understanding about not only the current nuclear plants, but the RDA. And so as I consider the provisions that we have in this bill, cost and cost to ratepayers is certainly one that has been considered and brought to mind. And do I have a number that will say this is going to decrease rates by a half a percent or whatever? I don't. But I think when we look at the provisions that we included, whether it's weatherization, pre-weatherization, whether it's implementing solar on schools to save money for schools, or this in the same vein on buildings, there are a number of provisions throughout this bill that are very deliberately intending to decrease costs for Minnesotans because of the high energy rates that we have right now. And so we know that when you look at electric vehicles or the lifetime of a car, an electric vehicle will be cheaper because of less maintenance, because of it's cheaper to fuel a car with electricity than it is with gasoline. And so while I, to your point, do not have a percentage of money saved for each Minnesotan on it, that is certainly one of the high priorities as we put this bill together.
Representative Spinski?
Mr. Chair, is there anyone else that raised their hand?
Nope.
No? Okay. All right. Well, I'll keep going then, I guess. I don't have to, but I will.
You're welcome to stop if you'd like.
Oh, I know. Thank you.
We've got 8 minutes.
You know, Mr. Chair, you know, we're allowed a certain amount of time to ask questions, and I believe it's a duty of legislators to do that.
I'm happy
to utilize every moment that you can. So, Mr. Chair, is there anyone in the audience that could answer that question? Is there a rough idea within the industry? Is there a rough idea with, you know, where that potentially would be, the extra costs that are involved in this onto business and onto ratepayers? Is there anyone that could potentially answer that question? Anyone from Excel that would like to speak?
Not seeing anyone bounding down.
All right. Well, it is a concern. It is a concern. I think that's, you know, when you look at kind of the pillars of what our goal is, do you know, is energy more affordable? Is it safer? Is it less dangerous? And, you know, I think focusing, you know, other concerns that I have in the bill primarily is really the stripping away of local control. While I understand the idea behind the HOA, and I understand people don't like them and whatnot, but they are locally elected. And I think, you know, there's a reason why some of this stuff exists within those communities. And I think the state, having the state of Minnesota come down with a heavy hand into those communities and really essentially neuter them, you know, I think it's unfortunate. You know, I think that's, you know, if it is what it is. I don't live in an HOA. I probably wouldn't recommend it. I don't know. But, you know, I think just from an idea standpoint, that would be something that we did here as a legislature is unfortunate. You know, just looking at some other portions of the bill, you know, just the subsidies of the electric vehicles. You know, I think interesting. I just read an article that Ford Motor Company lost $3 billion on their electric car division, and it sounds like they're going to have some large some bringbacks. And you know, one of the things that I spoke with Representative Stevenson 2 years ago when he was carrying this bill, I believe it was him, talking about the original MSRP, and you know, obviously some folks potentially buy used vehicles, and that if I don't know if you've changed the language at all, that if you were to buy a used vehicle, that if the used cost would potentially be below this, that if the original MSRP it was above that number, you would not be allowed to get it, or is it only for new vehicles?
Madam Chair?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, used vehicles are included in the EV rebates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does the bill fix the fact that if, let's say you buy an electric vehicle that was made 5 years ago, and it's used. So its current value is $20,000 or $10,000. But the original MSRP is above the number that you've set. Would that car be eligible to use the rebate?
I'm going to actually defer to Mr. Eloff. I bet he can answer that question for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at pages 32 and 33 of the DE. Limit on manufacturer's suggested retail price applies only to new electric vehicles. There is no indication for the used vehicles as to what the original price of the vehicle might have been.
My apologies.
All right. Thank you. So if you were to just go out and purchase, let's say you're going on Bob's Auto Lot and you bought a used vehicle that was $20,000, you could go out and use a $7,500 regardless what its original price was, it would take just whatever the purchase price was?
I'm not sure I follow your question, Representative Swinzinski. The rebate amount for new vehicles is $2,500. It's $500 for a used vehicle.
Okay. But there's no way to, so the $500, would you be able to get that $500 if the original cost of that used vehicle was, let's say, $100,000?
Mr. Chair, Representative Swinzinski, I believe the way the bill is written, you could do that.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know. Thank you.
Representative David.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Swinzinski, for letting me make a comment. Thank you, Representative Acom. So Representative Swinzinski brought up three things there. Is it safe? Is it affordable? And he doesn't want something that's dangerous. And the word reliability comes to mind. I'm new here on the Energy Committee, and I've been listening intently over the last few months, and I'm really concerned about reliability. I never thought a year ago I'd be looking at the MISO app on a daily basis, but here I am, I do. And, you know, I look at what our grid's running off of. And the three main things that our grid's running off of is coal, natural gas, and nuclear. And typically, they're running about 75 to 80% of our energy grid. And here we are, we have legislation in front of us that is screaming towards a goal of being completely carbon-free by 2040. And what we're putting that money into is mainly wind and solar. And we know that solar only works when the sun is shining, and wind turbines only go when the wind is blowing, unless it's blowing past like 35 miles per hour, then they shut down the wind turbines. And typically, the wind energy on the grid is usually running, I don't know, 15 to 20%. Doesn't get much over that when I'm looking at it. I think the highest I ever saw was 28% or something. And then we heard, and so we're going towards wind and solar, and then we've got to figure out how we can store this energy. And if I remember correctly, I believe I heard testimony that the technology does not yet exist in order to store energy for the amount of time that we're going to need to store it for. And we live in one of the coldest places in the United States of America. And I know personally this last winter, I wasn't able to use my furnace because the electric grid in my area, the electric went down for a 37-hour period of time when it was below zero. And I had to heat my house on wood, which is carbon. And then I remember Representative Igo had an amendment that got shot down on the House floor protecting our ability to burn wood in our home. So I have some major concerns with this being dangerous and being reliable. I don't think we should be going this direction when the technology doesn't even exist yet and we're relying so heavily upon wind and solar to bail us out. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Acom.
Thank you. Not hearing a question, but we've come to the end of our time. I'm going to turn it over to Chair Acom for final comments for the day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to address the whole notion quickly as I'm saying or ending this around Representative Davis's comments around technology and reliability. And what I'll say is, you know, 20 years ago, There was so much we didn't know, especially around storage. And so I wouldn't say we're screaming towards this end. I think we're continuing to move toward the end we know we need to be at. We know how dirty coal is and how expensive, frankly, coal is. And so as we are looking forward and what we need to do, we continue to learn and innovate. And we've heard much about the increased technologies around storage, to the point now where they're working on 100-hour storage. And so we are making leaps and bounds in technology, and I am confident that we will continue to do that. But with that, I know we're late on time. Thank you all for being here. Appreciate the discussion today. All right. Thank you.
We'll continue this tomorrow. With that, we are adjourned.